My name is John Junkins. I'd like to welcome you to the event this evening. This is the Eminent Scholar Lecture of the Hagler Institute for Advanced Study. We have one of these lectures per semester. We pick out one of the eminent scholars that we brought here as a part of the faculty fellow program operated by the Institute for Advanced Study. Also, this is a special evening. I'd like to give a welcome to all of the students who are members of the Honors Program. Welcome. Glad to have you here. We made the venue large enough to accommodate an unknown size audience, and it looks like we're beginning to have a pretty good turnout here. Thank you for attending. So the introduction for this evening's speaker is going to be given by Professor Rauschberger in computer science. Professor Rauschberger.
So today we have the honor and the pleasure to have Professor Jack Dongara give this interesting talk. He is a university distinguished professor at the University of Tennessee. He is a member of a large number of committees, of societies. He is a fellow of IEEE and ACM and SIAM and AAAS. He has received a large number of awards, so many can hardly even count them anymore. He is a member of the National Academy of Engineering, so that's kind of a little bit different. He is, in fact, a visiting professor at the Moscow State University and also a foreign member of the Russian Academy of Sciences. That is an interesting topic nowadays. But I, you know, we can list a lot of, you know, positions and awards that Jack has gotten over the years. But to me, as a computer scientist and particularly involved in high-performance computing, it is seldom that I have seen a person who is synonymous, his name is synonymous with so many achievements, so many packages, if you want, or products that everybody is using and that have become kind of like classical. So let me tell you a few things, right? There are all the linear algebra packages that we all know, but at least the people in the business know, and they are actually kind of the top of the line. And they continue because he invented it, that he came up with them at some point, made them open source, and they are still there. Like LIMPAC, every machine in this world will first be measured, the performance of every machine, every computer system, how fast it runs LIMPAC, linear algebra package. Some people say, well, it's not quite, you know, whatever, but it's still using LIMPAC. There is ISPAC, there is BLAS, basic linear algebra. There is LAPAC, ScalarPAC. There is NetLib. There is NetSolve. There is MPI, message passing interface that we all use, hate to use, but we use it anyway. There is PAPI, Atlas. Atlas was actually a very interesting development at some point because it's the first auto-tuning and still the most probably widely used auto-tuning system out there that auto-tunes, self-dynamically auto-tunes software to get better performance. So, as I said, there are so many things that we can actually attribute to Jack Dongara. I cannot really know, and I don't remember introducing a computer scientist that visited our department that has so many to his credit. So, without much ado, let's thank Jack for coming.
Well, thank you, Lawrence, for that very kind introduction. I'm honored to be here today. I'm honored to be part of the Institute, and it's hard to believe all those things that were just said, to be honest. So I do have a position at the University of Tennessee. I work at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, I also have an appointment at the University of Manchester in England, as well as a position here at Texas A&M. I'm going to talk today about high-performance computing and look at some of the things going on and a little bit into the future to see where we are positioned with respect to computing. So that's basically what we'll do for the next 50 minutes or so. I'm happy to take questions. Perhaps we should delay that till after the talk, but I'm happy to answer questions. So first, let me just talk about science in general. So we think about science being done through theory and experimentation. And today, those two things really have been augmented by simulation, computer simulation. So they help us understand what's going on in science and help us better understand the phenomena there. So sometimes it's difficult to carry out certain experiments, and we turn to computer simulation to help us with that. Perhaps it's a dangerous experiment to carry out. What happens if a jet engine ingests birds? Well, we can carry out that simulation on a computer without injuring people. That experiment was carried out a few years ago, and we know what happened as a result of that. Sometimes we can't actually carry out the experiment. So let's say we want to understand what happens when two galaxies collide. That's a pretty hard experiment to conduct. We can do that, of course, on a computer and get a better handle on that. So high-performance machines are used to help us engage in those experiments. The faster the computer, the more memory that we have, the greater fidelity and the better accuracy we can get through that computation. Our high-performance computers are used in many areas today. They're used to help us design better aircraft. They're used to understand things related to noise reduction. Weather forecasting, perhaps, is the thing where supercomputers touches us on a daily basis. When we look at the forecast, that's actually being carried out by high-performance computers that NOAA has using simulation to predict what's going to happen in the next 24 hours, 3 days, or in the week ahead. Deep learning, of course, is one of the big hot topics today in computing, and high-performance computers are used to drive that. So it has many applications in many areas. The past decade, we've seen this great change take place in computing, fueled by microprocessors. They become smaller, denser, more powerful, and the result is that these microprocessor-based computers are really the driving force for the supercomputers or the high-performance computers that we have today. The technology changes. You probably know the story as well as I do. Gordon Moore, one of the founders of Intel, a number of years ago made a conjecture about the rate of change that would happen in the microprocessor field. He wrote a paper which had these 5 points of predicting or projecting based on those 5 points where the microprocessors would go in the future, basically saying that the number of transistors on chips would double at a frequency of every 18 months. So new chips that came out would have twice as many transistors as they did in the previous generation. And that's held true. If we take a look at the Intel family of processors, that's held true since that statement and is continuing today. It's slowing down, perhaps, but it still continues today. So we have parts that have on the order of 20 billion transistors on them, affecting the way in which our processors operate today. And not only has it happened to processors, but it's also happened to various components in our computing system. So here's an image of a disk system back in 1956 that had 5 megabytes. Today we slide in a SD card into our camera, which has 125 gigabytes. So roughly 25 times the capacity of that large disk that was in operation in 1956. However, Gordon Moore, in that prediction with Moore's law, only holds part of the story. So Moore's law gave us more transistors on chips, but it's really the secret sauce here is Dennard scaling. So Robert Dennard is a scientist at IBM Watson Research Center, and he has the conjecture here, or this observation, that the voltage and the current are proportional to the linear dimension of the transistors. So if you make the transistor smaller, it has a really profound impact on how things work. So basically, Dennard scaling says we can decrease the feature size, the size of the transistor, by a certain amount, and we can decrease the voltage that's needed by that transistor, and we can increase the number of transistors by the square of that factor, and the clock speed also increases by that factor as well. So that's an incredible situation in terms of the chip characteristic as we decrease the feature size of those chips. So this energy consumption doesn't change as we undergo those dramatic changes. So we get two times the transistor count. We end up with something which is 40% faster and 50% more efficient. So that's where those transistors that are being shrunk according to Moore's law are being put to good use with Dennard scaling. So unfortunately, Dennard scaling ended, so we can't continue to do that shrink and maintain those ratios. So the problem is that we get voltage leakage on the chip itself, and that leads to the chip heating up. So we can't maintain that situation. The chip would heat up too much. So the transistor count is increasing, and that's going to continue in the foreseeable future, although slowing down. However, Dennard scaling is over, and that ended around 2005. That is, the leakage presented such a problem that the chip heats up too much, and we end up with a situation that we can't continue with that effect. And that leads us to a processor, which is roughly on the order of 130 watts today, which has that characteristic. So we can't continue to increase the speed of the processor, which was the effect of Dennard scaling, although we're getting more transistors on the chip, and that's going to continue into the future. So the question is, what happens to those transistors on the chip? Dennard scaling ended around 2004. Those transistors were originally put into a processor. The processor cycle time was getting faster. So in the old days, when I got a new computer, because of Dennard scaling, I saw an immediate increase in the efficiency of my program. I put my program on the computer, the new computer, and it ran a lot faster because of Dennard scaling. The cycle time had increased to the point where my application ran faster. Today, those transistors, I'm not gonna have the luxury of having the processor speed increase. Those transistors are being put to use by putting more processors on the chip, putting more cores on the chip. So today we see an increase in the number of cores on the chip where the processor frequency is maintained at a certain point. So now we have a processor which has more potential power. It has the same cycle time, but I have to do something in order to get that increased power. I have to write a parallel program. I have to write something which can effectively use those multiple processors and effectively use them to enhance the application that I have running. So I have to engage in this effort to effectively use the processing power that's there. So here's sort of the basic problem that we face. The power requirement for the chip is proportional to the voltage squared times the frequency of a chip. And modern processors, the frequency goes like the voltage. So that basically says that the power is going to go like the frequency cubed. So if I change the frequency, let's say I double the frequency, it has a dramatic effect in how much power is required. It requires now a factor of 8 more power to do that. And I can't maintain that or continue that operation, right? I can't continue to do that. We have a processor which is running at 150 watts, which is about the size of your fingernail, And if I make it run twice as fast, I have a situation which is going to be on the order of 500 watts in the area of your fingernails. So that's something which I can't maintain or can't cool. So the architects say, okay, we understand this. I'm going to give you, if I give you a processor which has 1.5 times the frequency, I need 3.3 times the power. But if I give you a processor which is multi-core, which has a lower clock time, 0.75, let's say in this case, I end up with the potential performance increase, because I have two processors over what I had with one, of 1.5. So I have a boost in terms of the performance potential, and I have less power being consumed by that processor. The power goes down because the frequency went down. So potentially I have a better situation. But that hardware issue just became a software problem, because now I have to write an application which can effectively use those two processors. And that's where the great challenge comes in today with respect to modern computers, effectively using the parallel processing capability. So our high-performance computers today are built out of microprocessors, commodity parts, in fact, from Intel, mostly. So here's sort of a cartoon of what happens. This is Intel, I think it's a Skylake processor, the new family of Intel processors, which are just coming to market. It has 28 cores on the processor. On that chip, there are 28 processors. We call them cores. They work. They can work independently. They can work in parallel or in concert to help us solve problems. In this cartoon, I've got a chip which has that socket on it. And in this cartoon, I'm using four cores. So there are four processors in this particular case. And we can think about writing a program which coordinates across those four cores, transfers information on that socket, allowing those cores to share memory, effectively getting access to the data in a very uniform way. Our processors or our computers are built out of multiple chips. So we think about a board, and on that board we're going to place multiple sockets, each of those sockets having multiple cores. And again, we can program that where we have a shared memory paradigm. Again, all those cores or all those processors sees that memory, and they can effectively use that to help us in solving problems. Sort of the trend today is to look at augmenting those commodity processors with something that can boost the performance. And we think about boosting the performance by using something like a graphic processing unit, a general purpose GPU. So those chips are augmented by an accelerator that we can use to boost the processing power. And the way you should think of this is that chip or that socket is in control, and it sends data over to the GPU. The GPU does part of the computation and then sends it back to the chip itself to carry on things. So it's used to supplement the processor, offloading the computations that can be done across that ensemble. And we're going to take that and do computing in the case of one node or one board. That's a shared memory operation where we can communicate across that using that shared memory paradigm, exchanging information through that common memory system. Our computers today are built out of those boards, and we think about connecting a bunch of those boards together and putting them into a cabinet and connecting them with cables and carrying out a computation. And that computation then would basically be in a position of exchanging information across those node boards. And that exchange of information is done through a distributed memory paradigm. So where we actually have to engage in passing messages, sending and receiving messages in our program to coordinate the execution across that system. On a single node, the computation can go on as a shared memory paradigm, exchanging information in that common set of memory, and also within the node, and then across the cabinet, they have to engage in this sending and receiving of information. So that's one cabinet, and of course we're not going to be satisfied with one cabinet. We're going to basically fill up a room with a bunch of cabinets, and the way you should think of modern supercomputers is a room about the size of this room here, or a little bit bigger. It's about roughly about the size of a basketball court, filled up with cabinets carrying out a computation across that ensemble to do some a very large-scale simulation that we want to achieve. So here's sort of the state of supercomputing today. So we have various ways of ranking machines, and we typically think of operations per second. And I'm going to be talking about floating point operations per second, or FLOPS. And our systems today are capable of operations that are measured in terms of petaflops of computation. So petaflop is 10 to the 15 floating point operations per second. So think of a machine filling up a room about this size, carrying out a single computation, perhaps doing something like a weather prediction, climate model, or some simulation of some criticality experiment for a nuclear reactor. And that computer has the ability to carry out operations or carry out the computation at a rate of 10 to the 15 floating point operations per second. Whenever I talk about floating point, I'm talking about 64-bit floating point operations. So what we typically think of for scientific computing. So today we have, if we take a look at the fastest computers in existence, there's 117 computers which have petaflops or greater capability, 117 systems which have that rate of execution in operation around the world. And we see three technologies that are being used to drive those high-performance systems. The first technology is very common. It takes commodity processors, we put them into a box, as I've described in the previous slides, and connect them together using some kind of interconnect, perhaps a commodity interconnect like InfiniBand or even Gigabit Ethernet to being used to connect those devices together. So that's the first mode of operation. The second mode is to use that commodity processor together with an accelerator, again, that GPU, as I described, to augment or to boost the power of that computer, offloading certain parts of the computation to that device to help accelerate the overall computation. And the third is to use what's referred to as a lightweight cores, cores which have very simple computing power, but many, many of them being used together. So one of the simplest cores that we have are the cores that are in your phone. So there's a company called Arm that makes the processors that are used to drive the technology that's in our phone. Those are very simple processors. So we have examples of machines being put together with those kind of processors. And there are very large machines that are put together using a processor that Intel has called Intel's Knights Landing. So that's a simple version of the x86 architecture, the architecture that's in the commodity processors, but a little bit simpler version of it, which is put into a chip. Today there are 68 cores in that chip using Knights Landing. And the third example I have is from a Chinese processor. So this is a Chinese-built, indigenous design, manufactured, fabricated processor called the Shenwei, and very simple processors. And we'll take a look at that processor in a little detail. Okay, and we see growing interest in supercomputing worldwide. So there are many activities today engaged in high-performance computing. We have a list of the 500 fastest computers. And one of the things that I find really striking in that list of the 500 fastest computers is that about half of the computers in the list are used in industry. So they're not used in government research facilities. They're not used in an academic situation. They're used in industry. Industry gets it. These machines can provide some advantage, some competitive advantage for the products that they're producing. So they've made an investment in high-performance computing. They engage in that to help them design better devices. Exascale computing, 10 to the 18 floating point operations. There are many projects ongoing in terms of trying to achieve that next level, let's call it. So a billion floating point operations per second. That's a staggering amount of computation, and somehow we have to harness that or aggregate that computing power to effectively drive our computations. And perhaps the most striking thing here, in that list of the 500 fastest computers, if we take a look at the processors that are used there, in 92% of those machines, they're using Intel processors. So the processor you have in your laptop, most likely, Intel x86 architecture, is being used to drive high-performance computing. So Intel has this, I'll call it stranglehold on high-performance computing. It's the thing which is driving high-performance computing today. It'll be interesting to see if that trend continues into the future. We have a list of the 500 fastest computers. So this is a list that's put together twice a year. We go out and ask people to run a benchmark, as was mentioned in the introduction, this thing called the LINPACK benchmark. LINPACK benchmark's pretty simple. It says solve this linear system of equations, AX equals B. And the ground rules for running this benchmark say you have to solve a dense matrix problem. The matrix is full, square, no non-zeros, and you have to use a prescribed algorithm, Gauss elimination with partial pivoting. It's the algorithm you probably learned in high school to solve that system of linear equations. So you have to implement it on your computer, running it in parallel, of course, operating at great efficiency, we hope, and solve it. And we're going to measure the rate of execution for solving your implementation of that algorithm, solving the biggest problem you can solve on your computer. So that's the benchmark. And now we're going to rank the computers based on the performance that they achieve from that application. And there's a list of data if you're interested. There's a website there that contains all the data. We've been doing this since 1993. So this is a snapshot, if you will, of supercomputing from 1993 until the most recent list was done in November of 2016. And what you're looking at here, this red line here is charting the computer at number one. So that's the fastest computer. So the fastest computer today is running at 93 petaflops, 93 times 10 to the 15 floating point operations per second. And the blue line here is charting the guy at the bottom of the list. So that just made it on the list. So if you think of this list as being the list which represents supercomputers. So that's the bottom of the list of supercomputers. 350 teraflops is the guy that just made it onto the list. And this orange line here is the sum of those 500 computers. So that's an artificial Excel sheet computation. So it's a little over 670 petaflops. Not quite at an exaflop yet. And you can see what's happened over time in terms of this list. This line here looks roughly straight. The guy who's number one, we see these jumps that occur occasionally. When a computer comes along, which is much faster than the previous generation computer, you see a big jump that occurred. Another one occurred here. This is on a logarithmic scale. And many interesting things come out of this list. So, we take a look at the list and we realize that the guy at the bottom of the list, that was equal to the sum of all the computers back in 2003. So things are happening at this exponential rate. This incredible rate of change is occurring in our computers, and we see this incredible effect taking place. These computers that are number one are pretty expensive. They're on the order of $200 million. That's the investment that's made in the supercomputer. That buys the hardware. That doesn't buy the software. That's a whole other story about developing the software algorithms and all the system stuff that's needed. But the hardware is about $200 million. And after 6 to 8 years, that computer that was number one is no longer even considered a supercomputer. It falls off the list. So you have to make another investment of $200 million if you want to be current, if you want to stay relevant in this list. Now, I have a laptop up here. It's the new Apple Mac, and it has a pretty impressive processor in it. I can run the benchmark on my laptop, and when I do, I get 70 gigaflops. 70 gigaflops out of my laptop. That's a stunning achievement in terms of the computing power that I have. I mean, here's a machine that I use basically to read email. And I'm executing at this incredible rate of potential incredible rate of execution that I can use on an airplane for 12 hours It's an amazing technology change that's taken place. When you look at that laptop, that was basically faster than the number one machine back in 1993. In 1993, Los Alamos had a machine called the Thinking Machine with 1,000 processors, and it was the number one machine at that time, probably costing around $200 million. And now I have something I carry on a plane, which matches the performance of that computer. So big changes taking place in a short period of time. And I have a phone, I have an iPhone, and there's a benchmark that you can download, the Linpack benchmark, and you could download it and run it, an app for that, and it runs at 4 gigaflops out of my phone, 4 billion operations per second out of the phone. So that's an incredible rate of execution, and again, that would have been one of the fastest computers back in 1996. If you take a look at that and try to project where we're going in the near future, you get a curve that looks something like this. This is, of course, dangerous. We're on a log scale here and making a projection into the future. But basically, it says that, if we just back up a second, if we just take a look at achievements that occurred. So a major milestone was achieved back in 1997 when we reached a teraflop, 10 to the 15 floating point operations. And that was in a machine at Sandia National Laboratory called the ASCII Red machine, parallel computer being used to solve some of the very challenging problems at that time. About 11 years later, there was a machine at Los Alamos called the Roadrunner, and it achieved an execution at a petaflop rate, 10 to the 15 floating point operations. So it was the first computer to achieve that. And again, 11-year period. And if we look into the future, and extrapolate from that, it says that we should reach exaflop in roughly the year 2020. Again, about an 11-year gap in terms of the performance that's there. The Chinese say that they will make it there in 2020. That's the stake that they put into the ground. In the U.S., we have our plans in place for an exascale machine in the year 2021, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. But it's interesting to look back at this computer that's a teraflop. Today, we have a chip, the Intel Knights Landing, that runs at 3 teraflops. So we have a chip that runs at roughly 3 times the performance of that machine from 1997. And the Chinese part, the Chinese processor, is also roughly matching the performance of that Intel part today. Today we have a cabinet of the fastest computer that runs at 3 petaflops, or roughly the equivalent of that machine that was running at Los Alamos in 2017. So again, major changes taking place in a short period of time. Here's a look at the top 10 computers today. So these are the fastest computers that are in existence today. The number one computer is at the National Supercomputing Center in Wuxi. And that's a machine that's called the Sunway Tianhe Light. So it's a machine that was built out of a Chinese processor. It has Chinese parts. It has Chinese software. Everything about that machine was built in China. It has 10 million cores, 10 million cores. So if you're going to program this machine, you have to manage, coordinate, orchestrate those 10 million cores to effectively carry out your computation. It runs at 93 petaflops. That's the execution rate for that benchmark, and that's 74% of the theoretical peak performance for that computer. The theoretical peak is an artificial paper and pencil calculation. What's the cycle time? How many operations can you do per cycle? How many processors do you have in your machine? And that gives you the theoretical peak, and then you look at the achieved performance to calculate that. This computer runs at 15 megawatts. So that's the power consumption of the machine under load. So that's actually solving that benchmark problem, 15 megawatts. And that's the power just for the memory, the processors, and the network. It does not include the cooling power that's needed. Cooling's another 30% on top of that. Put that into context, one megawatt year, so if I had a device which ran for 1 year consuming 1 megawatt, I would be getting a bill for $1 million from the electric company. So to run that computer cost about $15 million to turn it on for that year period of time. So again, there has to be the infrastructure and the ability to effectively use that. This column here represents the efficiency of your computer. How many flops per watt do you get? So you want a lot of flops per watt. So this computer gives you 6 gigaflops per watt. And if you scan down the list here, it's one of the best machines. There is a machine here in Switzerland which is a bit faster. So that represents the list. It's a pretty stunning list of computers. There's a couple machines in China. In fact, the first two machines are in China. There are five machines in the U.S., a couple in Japan, and one in Switzerland. But that machine at the top is really quite impressive. It's a stunning achievement. You know, that machine has 10 million cores, 93 petaflops. You know, you have to add up the next 5 machines to get to the power of that one machine. So the next 5 machines have to be summed up to get the computing power that that one machine has. And if you take a look and compare the Tahoe Light against the number one machine in the U.S., which is this machine at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, it comes in about 5 times faster than the machine at Oak Ridge. In fact, if you take a look at the Department of Energy is a big investor in high-performance computing. It really drives science today that's being done at the Department of Energy laboratories. So that's both the laboratories at the NNSA side, the defense side, as well as the open science side. If you add up all the computers at the DOE labs that are represented on this list, this Tahoe Light is faster than the sum of them. That's a stunning machine, stunning achievement. So China is really making an investment here in high-performance computing. So that computer is based on this chip. That is, the Chinese computer is based on this processor. Again, it's a machine which is built, architected, fabricated in China. It has a Chinese-made instruction set. It's not based on Western instructions. It has 260 cores, so that's the processing power, 260 processors on that one die. And it has 3 teraflops as the peak performance, roughly the equivalent of that Intel processor at the top of the Intel chain today, the Knights Landing processor, in terms of performance. If we take a look at the details of that machine, we see that the machine has a relatively low clock cycle. 1.45 gigahertz is relatively low. Most of the processors today have a processing rate about 3 gigahertz. So it's running at a very low low rate, and that helps keep the power consumption at a minimum. It has 260 cores. Those are very lightweight cores. In fact, most of those cores don't even have cache associated with them. They have a local memory which is used under user control. So again, it poses an issue for the user programming this machine has to be able to control and maintain and take care of that cache, not under hardware control. And at 3 teraflops is the execution rate. So one cabinet of the machine has 1,000 nodes in it, and that cabinet is roughly 3 petaflops of computing power, and 40 cabinets make up the whole system. And again, that's a room basically the size of a basketball court. 125 petaflops is the theoretical peak rate for that computer, 10 million cores in that system, a fairly large amount of memory. The memory on this machine is last generation memory. It's using DDR3 memory. And again, the memory that helps keep the power budget under control. So the power issues there are kept under control by the frequency as well as the memory architecture. That's going to pose some problems in terms of efficiency. It has slow memory, so that means data movement is going to be a big issue in this computer. And again, it has that characteristic of 93 petaflops for the benchmark and roughly 6 gigaflops per watt. The cost of the machine is about $280 million, so roughly, again, in that neighborhood of that. And that includes the hardware, the building, some of the software that went into the design of that computer as well. So in high-performance computing, we have a prize called the Gordon Bell Award. So Gordon Bell is an architect, designed a number of machines. He designed, he worked for Digital Equipment in the old days. He designed the DEC VAX machine, a classic architecture that was there. And today he's a rather wealthy individual, and he wants to encourage people to write applications using parallel computing. So he has endowed an award which gives out $10,000 a year to the best implementation of an algorithm running on a high-performance machine that's better than the previous winner. So again, there's a competition that goes on, incentivized by this this award of $10,000. And the way this works is there's a big conference held in November called SC, Supercomputing Conference. It's held in the U.S. People submit papers to this conference. It's a very highly competitive conference in terms of getting papers published. And if you want to enter this competition, you would mark on your paper that you want to enter for the Gordon Bell competition. You would have to have run an application on a large parallel machine, hopefully competing and doing better than the last year's winner. So there's a committee then which looks at the papers and selects six papers or six applications to go forward in the competition, and one of them will be the ultimate winner, and that'll be decided at the SC meeting in November. This year, the six papers are listed here. There was a paper that was submitted by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory running on one of their big machines, another one from Imperial College running on a big machine in the UK. There was a paper submitted by the Japanese running on the biggest machine in Japan, and then there were three papers submitted by the Chinese running on the Chinese fastest machine. And one paper was selected as a winner, and the winner turned out to be the one that was run on the Chinese machine. It was running on the full machine, 10 million cores. It was doing an atmospheric simulation, basically a weather study on that machine, and it was judged to be the best paper for the competition. So the Chinese are making a significant investment in high-performance computing. We can see that in a number of ways. This is a look at the vendors that are listed on the 500 fastest computers, and we see some familiar names: HP, Enterprise, SGI, Lenovo, Cray, IBM, Dell, Fujitsu, and a bunch of other companies. But when you take a look at that list and look at where those companies are, 36% of the machines built are built in China that appear on the top 500 list. So a little bit more than a third of the computers on the list are produced by Chinese companies. So China, again, is making an investment in terms of high-performance computing. This is a tree graph. It has 500 rectangles on it, and each rectangle represents a computer. And they're organized by country. So the area of a rectangle reflects the performance of that computer. So the number one computer is this guy here. That's the one in China. The number two computer is here. And then the U.S. computers are listed. And you can see the breakdown. In the U.S., of the 500 fastest computers, 171 are here in the U.S. China has also 171 computers. So that's the first time China has achieved that that number of computers. And it's the first time that the U.S. has dropped below 50% of the computers on the top 500 list. So again, it's an indication that China is making a substantial investment in terms of high-performance computing. In the U.S., there's an investment being made by the Department of Energy in terms of computing. They're buying three large systems that will be deployed. One machine will be deployed at Argonne National Lab, one at Oak Ridge, and one at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. Two of those machines will be based on IBM and NVIDIA technology, and the third machine will be based on Intel technology. So again, big machines on the order of $200 million each being deployed in by the end of this year and perhaps early next year. And then after that, we get to exascale. We get to 10 to the 18 mark in terms of computing. couple of years ago, the U.S. Realized that China was making this investment, and it took some action to stop China from acquiring Intel technology. So the Department of Commerce basically said that four places in China could no longer acquire Intel processors. And that was the National Supercomputing Center in Guangzhou, where they had the number two machine, the National Supercomputing Center in Tianjin, which has a very fast computer, the National University for Defense Technology, where those machines are being manufactured in China. That is, the university is a program to develop the technology, to educate students, and to build that technology, and the National Supercomputing Center in Chensha, where that where the NUDT is located. So that action by the Department of Commerce basically has, I'll call it, slowed down the progress in China in some sense of deploying high-performance computer technology. If we want to take a look at exascale computing, and let's say we wanted to build one today, the question is, can we do that? And the answer is, of course we can. We could build an exascale computer today. But if we did that, we would basically be taking 10 of those number one computers and putting them together. And if you did that, it would require 150 megawatts of power. That would be something which would be unacceptable in terms of the power requirements, $150 million just to turn that machine on. And it would require you to program it as if it had 100 million threads of execution, an incredible number of parallel processing. And it would require a price tag of about $2.7 billion. So obviously, we're not going to build that machine today. We're going to wait for the technology to catch up and be at a point where that machine would be affordable. China has three projects in line to build exascale computers. And again, they want to deploy that in 2020. There's a project going on at the National Supercomputing Center in Wuxi, basically to take the architecture that they have and to make a rev of it to produce the next generation of chips and use that to fuel high-performance computing. There's an effort by the National University for Defense Technology to build a machine based on the ARM processor. ARM is an architecture that's freely available, and they would actually fabricate the processors in China and build out that technology. And the third one is a company called Sugen, together with the Chinese Academy, that they're planning to build a machine based on x86 technology, Intel architecture, but do it through an agreement with AMD. So AMD somehow is allowing the license to be used in China to build a processor. Again, it'd be fabbed and made in China. Those are three big projects targeting exascale in 2020. In the U.S., there's a project, of course, to do the same thing. The target date is 2021. And in the U.S., it's called the Exascale Computing Program. It's a holistic program designed at looking at applications, software technology, hardware, along with vendor-supplied systems. So it's trying to integrate both the applications along with the software that's needed, along with the hardware technology to make that system available. It's a seven-year project in the U.S. designed to do that, which would deploy a machine in the year 2021 and also in 2022 or 23. And that'll be acquired by the Department of Energy to run on its systems. This program has started today, and investments are being made in various components. Again, it's a holistic thing, looking at applications, system software, looking at hardware technologies. So the Department of Energy has let out grants, sizable-sized grants, to effectively develop that hardware technology and make that available in the years ahead. If we take a look at a node that we expect to see in that exascale system, it looks quite different than the processing computing power that we have today. And that node would be based on various components. It wouldn't be based on a single processor chip, it was based on multiple processing chips. Some of those processors would have thin cores, very lightweight cores again. Some of those processors may be designed to have fat cores, or think of them like the commodity cores, and some would be based on some accelerated technology. And that would be used together with high bandwidth stacked memory. So today the memory that's being designed is not two-dimensional. We have a 3D stacking of memory. Think basically instead of having one substrate which has the memory on it, we have a stacked level of memory where data flows vertically through that stack and into the processor. And there's high capacity, low bandwidth storage as well for basically a burst buffer to allow data to be sent out and to be communicated very effectively throughout the system. As I see I'm coming close to the end here, let me go to some of my conclusions here. So with this move to exascale, we see a number of things. We see a qualitative difference that's going to take place in terms of how we effectively use these machines. It's similar to the move that we saw when we went to the petaflop level of computing. There was a radical change that took place when we had to engage in message passing. There was basically a rewrite of all the programs, all the applications that took place to do this send and receive paradigm within our applications. And that caused a lot of rewriting and rethinking about how the underlying algorithms and applications had to be represented. And with exascale, we're going to see that same kind of thing. We'll be faced with a billion threads of execution that we have to maintain and effectively keep coordinated within our applications. So core numerical methods and scientific computing will have to be readjusted, rethought, and re-implemented to effectively use the technology there. And the results will be this potential big gain for science and engineering as we can effectively use those computing parts. I do research in developing linear algebra algorithms, and here's sort of my list of things that keeps me excited about the whole effort. Excited in terms of great challenges ahead in designing algorithms that can effectively deal with this level of parallelism. The first thing is we have to think about getting out of this mode of a synchronization done across loops. We think about parallel processing as being done through a loop-level mechanism. We have a loop that we want to run in parallel. And that creates a fork join, it creates a bulk synchronous kind of parallelism. But that requires us to synchronize. So I have a billion threads of execution that are running, and now I have to wait until they all stop at this point here before I can continue the execution. And I can't sustain a program like that. I can't sustain efficiency when I have to engage in that level of parallelism. So we have to break that fork join model in terms of the algorithms that we have. One of the big issues today in computing is the cost of communication, passing data around in the system. Our machines today are really over-provisioned for floating point operations. And the basic cost and the energy that we consume comes because we have to pass data around in the machine. So we want to reduce the amount of data, so it becomes a critical thing. We want to rethink the algorithms to come up with methods which pose the lower bound in terms of the communication that we engage in. So thinking of algorithms which have that characteristic of the lower bounds is an important thing. You want to think about mixing precisions, mixing both 64-bit and 32-bit arithmetic. 64-bit is what we commonly think of in terms of scientific computing, but if we look at 32-bit arithmetic, it runs twice as fast. That is, the operations take place faster, as well as moving around less data. We have 32 bits instead of 64 bits to move around. So we have a double win in terms of that. And perhaps we can exploit that in our algorithms to get a much more effective computation, doing perhaps that short precision at the beginning of an iteration, and later looking at 64 bits to refine the computation. You want to think about auto-tuning and building it into the software. So auto-tuning is a way to adjust things so we get the maximum efficiency, adjusting the knobs and dials on the software to get the right setting so it can run efficiently. But I don't want to leave it to the user to do that. What I want to do is to build that into the system and have the system, the software, effectively drive that. We want to be able to resist failure. So one of the big issues today is if we lose a process, today the whole application falls over. So if a process fails because of hardware failure or some other glitch happens in the system, that application is ended. We want to be able to design things which can transition past that kind of failure. With the number of processors and switches we're talking about in the machine, failure is going to be an option, and we have to design things that can sustain across that kind of failure. And the final thing that we want to think about, at least, is reproducibility. So the idea here is, today when I run an application on a machine and think about running that same application on that same machine tomorrow, the reality is I may not get the same answer. And I may not get the same answer because I can't guarantee the way in which things are combined. So on a modern system, I can't guarantee that that sum operation is going to be done in the same order in parallel. And as a result of that, I'm going to get different round-off errors. And those round-off errors may have a profound impact in terms of the overall accuracy that I see or the results I see in the solution. That may be of concern to some people to have exactly the same results. It is a concern for people designing nuclear reactors to certify that that code is running correctly. To be honest, it's a concern to me when I'm trying to debug a program. I want to get the same answer today and tomorrow on the program, at least to be able to have a sense of where the error is in the application. So reproducibility becomes something that's important. Okay, so in conclusion, let me say it's an exciting time to be involved in high-performance computing. We've seen this incredible situation take place over the last decade, the changes taking place in terms of how the hardware has changed. And today we realize that we need to balance that with changes taking place not only in the hardware through things like Moore's Law, but also in terms of software ecosystem that we have, being able to invest, make the investment in terms of the applications, the software, the operating systems that are really required for these kinds of computers. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, so now we have some time for some questions and hopefully some answers. Go ahead.
So you said that reproducibility is an issue. How big of a difference is there generally? So
So that's a good question, and it's going to depend. So it depends on certain conditions. It depends on if you have a stable algorithm associated with your computation. So you can have an algorithm which small changes to the algorithm may produce large changes in the solution. Round-off errors are the things we're talking about in terms of the differences when we sum up things. And the magnification may occur if you have an algorithm which is an ill-conditioned algorithm. So an ill-conditioned algorithm, we can think of many, many ill-conditioned algorithms, but think about inverting a problem in the wrong way of inverting a problem. Gaussian elimination without partial pivoting is an algorithm which is unstable. I can't predict what's going to happen. Small changes will produce large changes. The other thing that might happen is you may have an ill-conditioned problem. So it's not a question of the algorithm, the method. It's a condition associated with the problem. Think about inverting a singular matrix or a matrix which is near singular. Round-off errors cause major changes then in the answers that we have. And as a result of that, you could see dramatic shifts between raining and snowing out or sun shining or cars crashing or not crashing depending on what you're trying to control. So reproducibility could be an issue in that context depending on the problem or the conditioning, the algorithm itself that's used.
I have a question then.
Please.
Is that something completely new?
Well, these are old problems. This is nothing new here. This is not something that happened because of parallel computing. Ill conditioning is a situation that we have. And we have error bars. As a numerical guy, I have error bars around my computation. So I know that if I do this computation with this algorithm, I can give you that error bar. So I know that my results will be within this limit here. So the software we design has just that characteristic built into it. And if we're willing to live with error bars, then we're in good shape. Some people have to have exactly the same results, though, because they want to certify a reactor, and they must have the same results today and tomorrow.
Well, I have bad news for you. They don't build reactors anymore.
some countries do, not in the U.S. Okay. Well, no, there's somebody else behind you, I think, who got the mic first.
Sorry. So what resources does China have that gives them such a competitive advantage for computing power?
So what resources do they have? So they have the money, the funding, they have the will, they have the desire to move in that direction. The government is willing to make that investment in that. So they started out with zero supercomputers. The thing I didn't mention is in 2001, they had zero supercomputers, zero. And they had this incredible growth in terms of the market, overshadowing Japan, overshadowing what's happening in Europe, and now matching what happens in the U.S. The processors that they have are lagging behind one generation in terms of the technology. But that's going to change quickly. That changes quickly. That can be brought up to speed. So they have the desire to do that. They realize that this is an important issue, and they're willing to make the investment in it.
Is there like an actual situation that arises that forced the government to put more investment into it?
So was there a situation that arose? So the U.S. Department of Commerce action of saying that those four places could not obtain U.S. technology created a situation where the government invested more in high-performance computing as a result of that. And the decision was to build supercomputing with anything but from the U.S. in terms of the hardware. Right, so that was the result of that action by the Department of Commerce. So a more investment in research going on in China.
Hi, the first question is that you talk a lot about the architecture inside the board. Or one node, but how about the interconnection between different boards, such as the topology, the protocols, and also maybe the router architecture? Do you think they have a very important role in this supercomputing?
Right. So that's an extremely important issue: is about what kind of network is inside your machine for passing data, and how efficient is that network for passing the information? It's all about data movement in terms of efficiency. Data is the most important thing. Floating point operations, that becomes secondary today. It wasn't always like that, but that's the situation that we have today. Data is the most expensive thing. Data movement's the most expensive thing that goes on in our machine. And making sure that we have a good network, network at various stages. There's many networks in our computers today. We have networks which move data around within a single chip. We have networks that connect those chips on a board. We have networks that allow those boards to communicate with each other, and then across cabinets we have networks. So there's many networks at each level there, and today we have a mixture. The fastest machines usually have custom networks associated with it. So at the highest level they have a customized network to make that very efficient communication. At the lower levels, the machines which are not as high performance, they're using commodity networks. Again, things like InfiniBand, off-the-shelf network, or even gigabit Ethernet is being used in some of those products. So a mixture is being used. The fastest computers are using customized things to do a very good job of that data movement, and data is the most expensive thing that goes on in the machine.
Second question is that regarding the accelerator, do you think, is there any other candidate solution other than the GPU, such as FPGA and other solutions?
Right, so today people are using GPUs. NVIDIA is the biggest one in terms of GPUs. They have, again, a big market. They've done a very good job with their product, and they do a very good job of developing applications that effectively use that. Today, GPUs are in an awkward position. Data has to flow from the main processor to the GPU, and that's being done across a very thin pipe, a very very low bandwidth pipe. So again, you're offloading data, you do a computation very fast, and you got to move the data back. So you want to minimize the data movement. Data movement, again, is the most critical thing. So that pipe there is really the bottleneck. That's going to change in the future generations. Things will be more tightly integrated, and be able to run things faster. You mentioned FPGAs. So FPGAs is another solution, field programmable gate arrays, a customized piece of hardware to do a specific thing. It's very very good for a single application. You would want to design something almost at the hardware level for that application. But it's a very difficult thing to do in general. That is, it's difficult to program for general purpose computing. So we don't see as much GPA deployment as FPGA deployment in high performance computing or at this level as we do at more targeted things like building a processor that goes in your refrigerator.
Thank you.
Jack, I have a probing question. Looking to the future of computer hardware, what are your thoughts on quantum computing and how that will play in the future generation supercomputing?
So quantum computing shows great promise for computing. I personally think that it probably will not occur in my lifetime, quantum computing. Quantum computing is going to give you sort of an approximate solution too. It's not going to give you the solution to your problem. So reproducibility, if we're looking for reproducibility, it's going to give you a fuzzy area where your solution may lie, and it doesn't apply to all problems. Right? So you can't solve all problems using a quantum computer. You can solve some very important problems, but not everything can be fit into a quantum computer. So I don't think it's something that we're going to see in wide adoption. It'll be used in a specialized device for solving very targeted applications, again, which are very important. And it's not something which is going to give you the dot-on precise solution to a problem. It's going to give you this probabilistic effect of a solution.
Sure. Well, thank you very much, Jack. I think it's a good time to call a halt. I have a gift I'd like to give you, so I need to join you on stage. I have here something for your bookcase. It's from the Hagler Institute for Advanced Study, Eminent Scholar Lecture Series, Current Trends in High Performance Computing and Future Challenges by Jack John Guerra, March 21, 2017.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Next door.
Hello, everyone. Just a quick note that the reception is just next door, and there's some treats in there. So please join us in there, and we'll get Jack over there soon.